I have recently become acquainted with Perry Marshall and have enjoyed getting to know him a little bit. Perry is an engineer by a training. Left, I don't know how long you practiced engineering, but at some point you went into
a few years
and became a salesman for technology products and began transforming the way he thinks about sales in that role. And now, more recently, in the past few years, founded Perry Marshall Associates, which is a firm in Chicago that consults with companies looking to improve their sales and marketing for technical products sold businesses. But Perry has many interests, many broad interests, including things having to do with science and faith. And today he'll be speaking to us about the relevance of information theory in this area. So welcome, Perry.
Well, nice to meet all you guys. I don't know most of these faces, so it's really great. We definitely have a very interested bunch of people here because I am competing with a very beautiful day outside, and I recognize that. So I appreciate you being here, I'm going to be my talk today is called "The Atheist Riddle: Language, Information, and the Case for Intelligent Evolution." I've always been a person who believes that when there's two sides of a vigorous debate, that there's elements of both sides that are right. One word for that is called the dialectic. And there's also, when there's a vigorous debate, there's also certain things that tend to get overlooked. And my path through life includes getting an electrical engineering degree, specializing in communication systems and control systems. And then over a period of the last 12 years or so, having one foot in the engineering world and one foot in the marketing world. And that creates some very interesting things because most people think that that marketing is a black art or is it some kind of bizarre voodoo. And it can actually be done in a very scientific way. And I'm going to talk about how interestingly enough, stuff that I do every day in my job has a bearing on this whole creation evolution debate, and I'm gonna show you that. And also, along the way, I authored a book called Industrial Ethernet, which is in its second edition. It's published by the Instrumentation Systems and Automation Society, which is it's the largest trade association for process control engineers. And so this is a book about Ethernet and TCP/IP and all the stuff that goes on basically on the internet and in computer networks. This book has a slant towards the industrial kind of person, but really it's an Ethernet book is what it is. And co-author is a friend of mine named John Rinaldi. And about a year ago, I wrote this book about 3 years ago. About a year ago, I kind of got pulled into this whole creation evolution debate because of a friend of mine. And I really hadn't, spent a lot of time thinking about it in quite a few years. It wasn't really that big on my horizon. I kind of got pulled into this, and we're having these discussions about, well, if you had 500 million sparrows flying around and you had 500 million years, don't you think that some of them could grow a new muscle, develop some mutation, that it would be beneficial, and all this kind of stuff, and all the usual things that come up in the creation evolution thing. And the fact is I'm not the kind of guy to be particularly dogmatic about, well, you know, God made sparrows exactly the way they are on the very first day and they're still the same way, or how much evolution might have or might have not happened in the history of the world. So I started investigating this, and curiously enough, I started finding out that the stuff that I know about digital communication from Ethernet and the internet and all the packets that zing back and forth across the internet, it all ties together. And it's all very relevant to the discussion. And in fact, if you look at it from that point of view, you have the ability to get down to some really core issues that generally are never discussed. So I'm going to be talking about that stuff. But let's get going with this. And we're going to talk about today, what do languages and information theory say about evolution? What is information? You ever thought about that? What is information? We all have this sort of qualitative idea about what information is, but can you define it? If somebody said, tell me, define information, what is it? What does it consist of? Do patterns and information occur naturally? And then new directions for the whole debate. I think the wrong things are being argued about out there. And the argument that's going on in most of the world between Christianity and secularism, or between any form of theism and secularism, is mostly focused on all the wrong things, all the wrong questions, such that you'll never get to an answer. And so now that benefits people who want to sell books, because the atheists, they print more books and they sell more books. And the Christians, they print more books and they sell more books. I'm a marketing guy, remember? I know how all this stuff works. And they just throw money at each other, and or they zing barbs. And, you know, it's like if you're an atheist and you publish an atheist book, you can be sure that 90% of your buyers are going to be rabid atheists, and then 10% of them will be rabid Christians trying to see what the other side is saying. And then nobody in the middle really buys any books at all. They just watch everybody go back and forth. And so I think this is very interesting, even just from that point of view. But I think this discussion needs to move forward, and it needs to get down to first principles. So the first thing that I want to point out, I think the starting point for this discussion, is the difference between a pattern and a design. Nature does have self-organizing properties, does it not? Mountains, tornadoes, hurricanes, fractals, there's all kinds of patterns that happen in nature. Crystals, snowflakes. Not all patterns are designed. Snowflakes are not designed. Okay, but all designs have patterns. Okay? The difference between patterns and designs is the defining issue in getting anywhere in understanding this whole naturalism versus design issue. So I'm going to talk about some naturally occurring patterns and talk about how they happen. This is a picture of stalactites. Last summer, my family, we were in Luray Caverns in Virginia. I don't know if any of you ever been there. It's this place where one day some kids noticed that this mud seemed to be sliding into this hole, and they had no idea where it went, and they started digging around, and they, lo and behold, this is the late 1800s, they find themselves in this huge, huge cavern. They take a candle down there and they start looking around, and I mean, this thing is enormous, and it's been there, looks like, for millions of years. And what happens if you have a big hole in the ground and you have a bunch of rock and a bunch of minerals? Water plus minerals plus gravity plus time equals all of these beautiful stalagmites and stalactites. And I mean, it was really cool, and they had it lit up, and you could go through there. It was like, how 200 or 300 feet below the ground. It was just amazing. They had pools of water, and when they were perfectly still, it was a perfect mirror image of what was below and what was above. So that was cool. Stalagmites and stalactites, they happen all by themselves. All you need is this process in time. Tornado, there's a funnel cloud. Hot air plus cold air plus moisture plus time, you get tornadoes and hurricanes. I'm not much of an astronomer, but from what I understand, there's hurricanes going all over Jupiter all the time. They just go and go and go and go, right? And when the right conditions happen in the Earth, you get a tornado, like in the Midwestern United States. You get the right conditions and the right, you know, hot air in the right place, warm air in the right place, certain amount of moisture, you get a hurricane, and it happens. And it happens without anybody designing it. Snowflakes. All you need is the right temperature of air, certain variations in the temperature, water, gravity, wind. You get snowflakes. And every single one is different. Okay, and they grow symmetrically, and you know, you can go buy snowflake books and you can just turn the pages and turn the pages, and there's snowflake after snowflake after snowflake. Okay, and it happens all by itself, and nobody has to design that. Now let's talk about music. I got this little picture of a sheet of music. I got a picture of a band. If my PowerPoint slide worked the same way it did at home, but it doesn't, I could click on this picture and you hear the strings playing. Now, music can be represented in at least two forms. Okay? You can hear it. You can also write it on a piece of paper. And they're the same thing. Okay? Or they can be. Now, if somebody decides to play it different than the way it was written down, it's going to be different. But at least in principle, the symbolic representation of music mirrors the actual implementation of music. And it has two forms. And of course, you could come up with different nomenclature for representing music. We have the standard, you know, the bars and the notes and the quarter notes and the eighth notes and the time signatures. But music exists in these two forms. Washington, D.C. What you have here on the left is a map of Washington, D.C. What you have on the right is a photograph of Washington, D.C. Okay? Now, the map could have been created for the purpose of this discussion before it was built. It could be created after it's built. But one represents the other. And there's different ways of drawing a map, but they all tell you that Pennsylvania Avenue is at a certain place and certain streets cross it. And all the maps of Washington, D.C. are going to have that. There is a symbolic representation and there is an implementation of Washington, D.C. And they both match each other. Microsoft Windows. On the left, you have a bunch of ones and zeros. Okay? That is the essential nature of Microsoft Windows. Okay, on the right you have a picture of a screenshot of, you know, one of the menus in Microsoft Windows. So there is the representation of Microsoft Windows, which could be on a CD, it could be on a hard drive, it could be on a zip disk. You could be transferred over the internet, but that symbolic representation is always the same. And then there's the implementation. So you always have these two versions of something. You have the representation of it, and you have the reality of it. Okay? Chinese. Now this is interesting because with Chinese, there are two different symbolic representations of Chinese. Yang Bao, to hug, Gaga, older brother. Yang Bao, if you look in the... I'm probably butchering the tones of Chinese. You know, the way that you say the vowel, there's four different ways to say each vowel, and I'm probably saying, you know, fell off a horse or something. But on the left, you have the Chinese character, okay? Now, the Chinese character is not the same as an English letter. It's more like a word or a part of a word. You take several Chinese characters together, one or two or three maybe, and they'll represent a word. Or sometimes they'll represent two words. It's not a direct correlation. But in the case of these words, these characters mean older brother. Okay? Actually, they don't mean gaga. They mean older brother. That's what the picture means, okay? Then this the second one where it's written in English letters, gaga, that is called pinyin. And pinyin is the sound, the English representation of the sound of it. Okay? Now, most Chinese people don't deal with pinyin. They never learn it. They might learn it later, but like kids, when kids learn to read, they don't sound out words the way our kids do. They see a picture. The picture means man. The picture means country. The picture means dog. So the parent says, that means dog. And they teach them how to write that symbol, and they say, whatever dog is, okay, whatever the word is. Pinyin is a way of dealing with the fact that English and Chinese are represented completely differently. In English, we represent the sound of the word. In Chinese, they represent the thing you're talking about. So it's two completely different things. But here, they mean the same thing. Gaga, same as older brother in English, same as this pictorial symbol. They all are representations of the sound. Now, I've got the sound on my computer, but I don't know how to play it. Otherwise, I would. But you could hear the person talking in Chinese. So you have the representation, and then you have the implementation. One symbolizes the other. Now, think about this. When you say older brother, that word is not an older brother. It is an agreed upon convention that we use to refer to an older brother. Okay? So the printed word is a representation of the sound, and the sound is a representation of the thing. Okay? So I showed you two kinds of things. I showed you things that are based on patterns, stalagmites, stalactites, tornadoes, snowflakes, and I showed you things that are based on information, music, Washington, D.C., Chinese characters, older brother, language. Okay, these things are fundamentally different. There is a huge chasm between the two. Patterns come from chaos. I remember about 15 years ago, my wife went to the library and she bought this book on fractals. You guys know what fractals are? They're the funky computer patterns that generate and have little spirals coming out of them and spirals off of the spirals. And sometimes they're these beautiful colors. And sometimes they look a little bit like trees or a little bit like plants, but they're very computerish. My wife brings home this book on fractals and chaos, and I didn't know anything about it. And I start reading this book, and it starts showing you all these examples of things that are chaotic. It's got, of course, fractals generated by computers. It shows snowflakes. It shows hurricanes and tornadoes. It shows stalagmites and stalactites and waterfalls and turbulence and patterns of the sand in the desert and rivers, like little streams running into bigger streams, running into creeks, running into rivers. And it talks about how, like, for example, how long is the coast of California? Well, as the crow flies, it's like 2,000 miles. But wait a minute. What if you like walked down the coastline with a little wheel and you measured it and you followed every little thing? It might be 3 or 4 times as long. Well, what if you followed it in microscopic detail and you followed every little place where the water goes in and out of the sand? Well, eventually you'd end up with a line that's almost infinitely long. A two-dimensional line becomes almost three-dimensional because it's chaotic. And fractals comes from the idea that It's fractionally dimensioned. It's not two-dimensional. It's two-and-a-half-dimensional.
It's self-replicating.
Excuse me?
The point is it's self-replicating at different scales.
Yes.
That's the essential point.
Yes, and the thing about fractal patterns is you zoom in and you see the same pattern, very similar pattern again. You zoom in, very similar pattern. You zoom in, and so it's really fascinating. And they're unpredictable in certain ways, but they're very predictable in other ways. And so I'm reading about this, and it's explaining there's kind of a philosophical aspect to this too, where there are no straight lines in nature, there are no perfect circles in nature, that everything kind of has this fractal aspect to it. And I had never thought about this before. And I remember the next morning I went out to my car, and it was a cold day in December, and I look on the top of my car, and there's all these ice crystals, these snowy-looking ice crystals on the roof of my car. And I go, my goodness, they're everywhere. And ever since then, I've never been able to look out the window and not see fractals. You look at a tree, think of a tree. You look at a tree, you zoom in. It still looks kind of like a tree. You zoom in, you zoom in, you zoom. You're in the leaf and you're looking at all these little things. And you see that pattern over and over and over again. Now, none of the patterns are exactly replicating. They're never exactly the same, but they're similar. And so everything on the left side comes from chaos. Okay? Mathematically speaking, all you need is a nonlinear differential equation and you can get chaos. Patterns are based purely on matter and energy. Fractals and chaos happen all by themselves, just putting matter and energy together. And then another thing is, there is the similarity where, you know, the tree looks like the branch, which looks like the twig, which looks like the leaf. But in the world of chaos, nothing ever happens exactly the same way twice. Okay, and I'll come back to this point a little bit. It's never exactly the same.
Question.
Yes?
Aren't they really questioning that now? They do believe that there's more than one snowflake that is identical, and there's more than one.
There is a very small statistical probability that yes, that does happen. But the point I'm making, and so yeah, somewhere in the world there might be another snowflake, but the thing is, the snowflake doesn't make a copy of itself. In fact, they don't actually make copies of themselves. They are just produced by the same process. Okay? And you change the littlest thing in the initial conditions, and the result is completely different. That's another aspect where part of this came from a guy at MIT. He coined the term butterfly effect. And the butterfly effect was, he's trying to model weather. He's trying to predict weather. And he's putting all the equations in the computer. And he finds out that if he changes the slightest thing at the beginning, 2 weeks later, the weather is completely different. And so what he came up with was this term called the butterfly effect, where a butterfly somewhere could start a hurricane somewhere else, or a butterfly somewhere could cancel out a hurricane somewhere else later, and nobody would ever know. That the world is unpredictable. You can't like plug all the numbers in, because you never know the numbers accurately enough. Patterns require no thought. Now, information has a different set of properties. Information is based on language. All of these examples on the right have a component of language. Language always involves matter and energy and will. Okay? I'll talk about that more. But they always require some mental process willing something to be done. In the world of information, you can make exact copies. Okay, any process that makes exact copies, so far as I know, is a mental process somewhere. Okay? And information can be transmitted via multiple media and it doesn't change. If I send you an email, you can forward the email to 10 of your friends and it doesn't change the content of my message at all. You could print it out on a piece of paper. It doesn't change the content on my message at all. It can go through 100 different kinds of internet connections on the way there and be converted in all kinds of different formats, whether it's fiber optic, radio wave, satellite, Ethernet. It still says the same thing. It can be read out loud. It can be read over the telephone. It can be shown on a TV screen or computer screen. It still says the same thing. This is a property that only information has. Patterns do not have this property. It's not possible to make a completely exact copy of a pattern without using a mental process to make a copy. It's a very interesting little observation there. And it requires thought. Somebody has to think for language to exist. So, the fundamental questions of evolution are, can patterns lead to designs? Can a pattern turn into a design? Or can a pattern become a language? Is DNA a pattern or is DNA a design? This is really the question. This is the question right here. This gets at the core of it. How do designs evolve? Designs evolve. Has the Toyota Camry evolved over the last 20 years? Sure. Has Microsoft Windows evolved? Yes. It's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. There's designs evolve. Languages evolve. How do they evolve? How does evolution actually happen if we go look at examples of evolution that we know about? So let's talk about DNA. DNA is a double helix. I'm just going to give a very simple explanation. Some of you guys are biology professors. You could explain it much better than me. I'm only really interested in the informational aspect of DNA, but basically, you've got this helix and you've got these chemicals bridging the gap, and it's got four chemicals, adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. And those four chemicals create a four-letter alphabet. Okay? And they encode all the information necessary for life. Okay? And in the very simplest microorganisms, there's about 500,000 letters in the DNA. In the very simplest ones, they've got about 500,000. In a human being or a very complex advanced mammal, 3 billion. So you've got a little string of letters, 3 billion characters long. And it makes copies of itself by dividing and then basically a soup of these chemicals, the complementary one attaches itself to the detached portion, and it's like a zipper that creates a new zipper as it unzips, and it makes a perfect copy of itself. Okay? And it's really amazing. I've never seen it happen on a microscope, but nobody can really talk about this without having a little bit of a sense of awe. But here's the thing. Just because you have a molecule that's DNA that's got all the right things to make DNA doesn't mean necessarily that those letters mean anything. You could have alphabet soup or alphabet cereal and you could pour it out on the table and you could string them all in a line. It doesn't mean that they say anything. So DNA has two properties. It is a molecule with all of these chemicals and amino acids and proteins and everything, but it is also an information encoding decoding system with a message. Okay? Now most of the discussion about where the first life forms come from is all about the chemicals. What I never seem to hear anybody talk about is where did the code come from? That's what we're going to talk about today. All those letters, 500,000 letters for a very tiny microorganism like Nanoarchaeum, which is so small that it's a parasite. It can't even live without being attached to something else. But it's got 500,000 letters that all say something. Yes, you had a question.
You just said DNA perfectly replicates itself. Is that what you said?
Well,
I thought that's what you said.
Most of the time. Now,
but not all the time.
Well,
because there's the mutations, right?
Yes, we're going to talk about mutations. It's supposed to make perfect copies of itself. Okay. And by the way, you know, in sexual reproduction, it does not make a copy of itself. It makes a combination between the mother and the father. But in asexual reproduction, it makes a copy of itself, right? So, we will talk about, and the mutations are very interesting, and that's going to be a big part of our discussion today. Does that answer your question?
Well, I thought you said
yeah, it does. Like,
it doesn't.
99.9% of the time.
That high?
Mm-hmm.
Much higher than that.
Well,
like
my son was born with club feet, and that's probably came from a mutation that got into the human genome, and you know, so then you got to straighten them out.
Is that like design or chance?
I would be tempted to say that's by chance. However, I don't know that. I don't. So
usually done by certain chemicals.
Oh yeah. So we're gonna come back to that. So that's basically how DNA works. DNA is not a pattern. It is a code. It's a language. Okay? And really no competent biologist would disagree with this. Linguistic analysis has been used very extensively to help decode the human genome. DNA actually resembles human language in many ways. It's very intriguing. It's got a 4-character alphabet as opposed to a 26-character alphabet. Now, like computer languages, they have a 2-letter alphabet, 1 and 0. DNA has A, C, G, and T. DNA is an encoding and decoding mechanism. And like I said, linguistic tools, like tools they use to study languages and computer programs they use to study languages, they actually study DNA and the patterns of the letters in DNA, and they discover that a nucleotide corresponds to a character. A codon corresponds to a letter in English. A DNA gene corresponds to a word in English. So, like, when you read an article that says, well, they found a gene for obesity, then what they're saying is there's a word in there that says fat. Okay? Or, you know, but I mean, that's what they're looking for. They're like, okay, this represents all the stuff that makes you. So how much of this is like a specific instruction to make you a certain way? So there's genes that make your skin, you know, red and yellow, black and white. There's genes that decide how tall you are, how short you are. Now, I am not a geneticist and I can't unpack all this, but I can just tell you that as a person who's studied computer communication protocols, and as a person who basically for a living is a writer, if you probably wanted to categorize what I do more writing than anything else, that this is language, okay? An operon corresponds to a sentence. A regulon corresponds to a paragraph. And so one strand of DNA has basically a whole encyclopedia set worth of information, and it gets perfectly copied almost every time. Like, like in my body, when one blood cell divides and turns into two blood cells, that is asexual reproduction, and it makes a perfect copy of itself, except as you get older, little by little by little by little, it starts making imperfect copies of itself, and you get old. Okay? Because like you don't heal up as well because the instructions aren't all there anymore. So, this brings us to the question, what makes a language? What are, you know, has anybody ever asked you, well, what is a language? How do you know if something's a language or if something isn't a language? Well, this is what language consists of. The fundamental property of language is that it symbolically represents something other than itself. Today's newspaper, or this little card right here, this is printed on paper and ink, but the message has nothing to do with paper or ink. It refers abstractly to something else. Okay? Now think about this. If you don't have an abstract representation of something else, you don't have language. If there is not language, you don't have any abstract representation of something else. So if we went outside the solar system to some other solar system and we went to a planet that doesn't have any life, there is nothing on that planet that represents anything other than itself. Rock is a rock. And it doesn't mean anything else. Okay? A star is a star, or cosmic radiation is cosmic radiation. It contains no symbols. It contains no alphabet. So a language is a symbolic representation of an idea. It requires a transmitter and a receiver, or a speaker and a listener. You cannot have language without those two things. If you don't have a transmitter, a receiver, a speaker, and a listener, you do not have a language. It's a two-ended thing. It has an alphabet. All languages have an alphabet. It might not seem like an alphabet, but it could be computer code. It could be pheromones that attract one insect to another. But it has an alphabet. It has a set of symbols that are agreed between the sender and the receiver to mean something. Okay? And in linguistics, there's a four-layer model, and the lowest layer, which contains the alphabet, is called statistics. It's the statistical level of the language. And the reason they call it statistics is, if I open a book, a book written in English, I will find that the letters E and A appear a lot more often than the letters Q and X and W. There is a statistical how often these things appear. So the alphabet level of a language is called statistics. All languages have grammar. Okay? In linguistics, it's called syntax. Every language has a syntax. There's rules of certain things that come before other things. There's certain things that never come after other things. I before E, except after C. Or if it's possessive, you put an apostrophe in it and stuff like that. Okay? Syntax. The third thing that all languages have is meaning. Is the message that comes out has to mean something. It's a request or it's a command. It communicates a complete idea. And in linguistics, this is called semantics. Okay? And the fourth thing that all languages have in common is intent, which linguists call pragmatics. Okay? You say, please bring me a cup of coffee. Your intent is to get a cup of coffee. There's always a reason why. Okay, so when a cell reproduces itself, the intent is to make a copy. There is a purpose. So language always has these four things. And if you don't have these four things, you don't have a language. Plus the transmitter, the receiver, and the symbolic representation of something. Most languages also have error correction and redundancy. I talk about this in my Ethernet book. You'd be amazed at how many error correction mechanisms are employed to get my email to you. There are layers and layers and layers of error correction. In the computer world, error correction is done by little things called checksums. Like before it sends it, it counts, it runs it through this little formula and comes up with a number, and then it sends it, and then the receiver runs it through the same formula and it checks to see if the number is the same, and if it's not, it says, "Send that to me again, please," and then it sends again. And so that's how computer languages usually do it. In human language, I'm going to talk about this a little more later, but in human language, like English is about 50% redundant. And what that means is if I'm talking to you on a cell phone and it's cutting in and out, we can still understand each other even if I'm only hearing you about half the time. Why? Because English, there's multiple things in your sentence that point to the missing part that your brain can fill in. And German is about 33% redundant. That means Germans have a harder time talking to each other on their cell phones than English people, but if they have a clear connection, they could say it faster. Because remember, they've got all these long, long words, you know. Yes, sir?
And that's true unless you're trying to give somebody a telephone number and you don't have a lot of redundancy.
Yeah, well,
that's one number you've lost.
That's right. That's right. If they miss it. And so there are certain things that, so that's why people's voicemail says, please leave your number twice so I can hear you clearly, right? So, DNA, is it a pattern or is it a language? Well, it's obviously a language. It's an encoding-decoding system. Who ever heard of an encoding-decoding system happening between rocks? Right? A DNA molecule symbolically represents something other than yourself. Every cell in your body has a symbolic representation of the entire plan for you. It's pretty amazing. Okay? It has alphabet, syntax, semantics, and pragmatics, and it can be copied and even stored in other media with no loss of information. I used to work for a company that sequenced DNA. They made DNA sequencers and sold them to researchers. And so you can sequence DNA and read all those little letters and store them on a computer disk. And at least in theory, you could take that information and then go back and recreate the DNA. Now, whether you can physically do it or not, that's a technical challenge. But at least conceptually, you can make a copy, you can store it, okay? A, C, G, and T are yellow, orange, blue, and purple. You could represent them as other letters. When I say A, you know what that is, even though A is not adenine. Adenine is represented by A. So you can make copies, and you don't lose any information. So, which is it more like? Is DNA more like stalactites, tornadoes, and snowflakes, or is DNA more like music and maps and computer programs and Chinese? So, the pattern in DNA is not like a language, it is a language. It is a language. It's an encoding-decoding system. Let me talk about interesting properties of language. I'm going to start at the bottom and work up here. On the alphabet level, anything on this piece of paper here, I pick up this piece of paper, and it's got this information. I could represent this piece of paper in Morse code. Would it change what it means? Wouldn't change a single word. My alphabet would just be different. I could represent it in ASCII, which is the name of the most common way of representing letters or numbers in computers. It's like A is, you know, this set of ones and zeros, and B is this set of ones and zeros, and all the characters on your keyboard are represented by ASCII, okay? If I represent this in ASCII by saving this in a text file on my computer, it doesn't change the meaning of this at all, even though the alphabet is completely different. I could represent Chinese in pinyin. It doesn't change anything that it means. On the syntax level, the car is red, is the car red? Same words. I move the is somewhere else, and a statement becomes a question. That's the rules of syntax in English for asking a question. You move the verb somewhere else, the syntax changes. Now, even though the alphabet is the same, and even though it's got all the same words, the meaning changes. On the semantical level, this one's interesting. Did he steal that car? Well, you can inflect it. You can say, did he steal that car? You can say, did he steal that car? 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 And every one of the, I just said five different things, same letters, same words, same sentence, different inflection, different meaning. Okay? Then I go up to intent. If I say, you've got a green light, what do I actually mean? Well, I might mean that we're sitting at a stoplight and we saw a green light and we can go now. It might mean that your proposal just got approved or something like that. It might mean that you're holding a green light bulb in your hand. It's the same sentence and the same syntax, same alphabet, same semantics, but the intent is different depending on the context. Okay? Now here's another one. This screen shows you screwing up one layer but leaving the other layers okay. So in the bottom one, if you read that, it says the phenomenal power of the human mind, but all of the letters are scrambled. Except for of, all the and the phenomenal and power and human mind, all the letters are completely scrambled. But you can still read it easily. Why? Because English is redundant, and because your mind has some pretty remarkable pattern recognition ability from doing like crossword puzzles or whatever, and so you don't have any problem reading it. Okay, but the alphabet is completely screwed up here. Syntax. If I say to you, dogs jumpy or strangers afraid of, you should avoid definitely. The syntax is completely wrong in that sentence, right? But don't you kind of get the idea what it means? You can kind of piece it together. Or how about this one? Julio cranks his sky for wooden cheese. I tried this on my four-year-old. I turned to him, I said, hey, Caden, Julio cranks his sky for wooden cheese. And he looks at me and he goes, that doesn't mean anything. And I go, Caden, you're right. High five. It doesn't mean anything. It has perfect alphabet. It has perfect spelling. It has perfect syntax. But it doesn't mean anything. All the verbs are in the right place and all the nouns are in the right place. But how does Julio crank a sky and what's wooden cheese? Okay. Now, then the top one is interesting. I believe, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's impossible to say anything without intent. See, if I made a sentence that I said didn't have intent, I would be intending to say made a sentence that is meaningless, which means that it still had intent. So how can I intend to not intend? I can't come up with a way of putting anything in that blank. Which is kind of an interesting thing. It's like, okay, tell me something without meaning anything. You know, I kind of wonder if this isn't like a little critique on postmodernism right here. Everything has intent. You might know what the you might not know what the guy meant, but he intended something. Information is always distinct from the medium that carries it. Okay? Whatever you're sending through the internet or whatever's coming to you over the AM radio has nothing to do with the electromagnetic waves. That's just part of the process, but has nothing to do with the information. Information can be stored and transmitted by matter, like in a book, or stored and transmitted by energy, like through sound or light. But information is not matter, and information is not energy. It is a different entity unto itself. Matter and energy all by themselves cannot produce information. They can make tornadoes, they can make hurricanes, they can make Jupiter swirl, they can make rivers and rocks and all kinds of stuff. But none of those things contain any information, because they don't contain any symbols that represent something other than themselves. Mark, you have a question?
Yeah, you might have just answered.
I was just going to say that doesn't the existence of a tornado on a planet, the Earth, tell us something about the weather conditions on that planet? And in so doing, that's information.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. This is a subtlety, but it's important. Okay, this room is like 70 degrees, right? Okay, 70 degrees is a symbolic conception of the room. It's not the room. It's not the air. It's a representation of it. All the air in this room is molecules vibrating. That's all it is. And it represents nothing other than itself vibrating. Okay, it's only a human conception. I've had some of this stuff on the internet for a little while, and I get emails from people, and they go, "Well, the number pi, that's information." No, that's a human construction of interpreting a physical constant. A physical constant is not information. The power of gravity is not information. It's just a force. We conceptualize it. And now when I put a thermometer in the room, now I've created an encoding-decoding system which produces information, which now I deal with. Yes, sir?
It can only be communicated if there is a language, if there is
right.
Understanding between.
Right. When we say 23 degrees Celsius, or we say 7 degrees Fahrenheit, it's language that lets us do that. We are so immersed in language that we don't realize that there's a whole universe out there, a whole entire galaxies that don't have a smidgen of language in them at all. Just like they don't have plants or animals or anything. We're so immersed in it, we don't even realize.
Pardon me. Your first point, though, what about McLuhan's idea that media is the message?
Well, that is a... I'm a little fuzzy on that, but as I understand, that's like a philosophical statement. The media, some guy named McLuhan said, the media is the message. Isn't that a statement about like what you see on TV and what you hear on the radio and...
Like, for example, when a church, for example, goes for projection and so forth, immediately there's a message that goes out to the congregation, hey, we're right up on everything.
Well, I would say in the human realm, information is never devoid of a context, okay? And you know how I talk about these four layers of information? In the human world, there's many, 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 many layers of information.
Your term was a completely separate kind of thing. I think your previous slide you had, and I just was raising.
Yeah. Well, it's a point. Did you have a question?
I make the comment that the term I've heard used describes the concept is that the information is not reducible
to the media, so it's irreducible. So in other words, the letters on a piece of paper are irreducible to the ink and paper. You cannot reduce them to just ink and paper.
Yes. And from a mathematical point of view, this postcard is more complex than a planet. Okay? Because a statistical process cannot produce anything like this. Okay? Even as simple and short as it is.
Well, the word complexity really means information.
Well, complexity is a confusing word because that word is usually used to blur the distinction between a pattern and a code. I think what all this evolution debate and everything gets down to is, wait a minute, don't blur the distinction between a pattern and a code. You could have an enormously complex rock formation that could take you gigabytes of data to represent or to videotape or to store or represent in any way. But it doesn't contain any information, even though it's complex.
But if you go into the human realm, it's the same, right? Like a complex system must have more information required to represent it.
Yes. Now, Norbert Wiener is known as the father of modern cybernetics. He was an MIT professor. He said this statement, and I think this is profound. Information is information, neither matter nor energy. Any materialism that fails to take account of this will not survive one day. Okay? The idea that information can come from a purely materialistic process is a materialistic philosophy that is not founded on any factual data. Okay?
Does anyone ever define information as not energy or matter?
Well, information is language with syntax, semantics, pragmatics, and statistics. A simple linguistic definition of information. It symbolically represents something other than itself with an agreed upon convention of symbols between a transmitter and a receiver. That is information. Nothing less than that is information. And as you look around you, kind of like me waking up one morning and seeing fractals and never being able to not see them again, as you look around you, you will start to see there's all kinds of things that involve information. And there's all kinds of things that don't, and there's a world of difference between the two. But they're all mixed together, and most of us never contemplated the difference until maybe today. So I look at it like this. Matter is like on one axis of a XYZ plane. Energy is on the Y axis, and information is on the Z axis. And in order for information to exist, there has to be a will. Otherwise, you're just confined to being on the X or the Y. It's like, if you don't have a mental process, then creating information without a mind is like driving your car to the moon. You could drive your car north, south, east, and west, but you cannot drive a car up. You have to have something that lifts against gravity to do that. So that's kind of an analogy here. You can have all this chaos, all these patterns, the mountains, the stalagmites, the stalactites, the snowflakes, all those things exist on the matter-energy plane. But as soon as you get to anything symbolic, you have made a quantum leap to a mental realm. Okay? So, William Paley and David Hume. I'm really oversimplifying these guys today, but basically here's what they said. William Paley said, if I walk around in the woods and I find a watch, I know that that watch didn't just happen. He says, how do I know that? It has an obvious purpose of keeping time. Therefore, it has a designer. Therefore, since life has a purpose, life has a designer too. That's the design argument. Well, David Hume said, hey, wait a minute. The analogy between a watch and life is weak. He says, you can't prove to me that life has a purpose. Therefore, you can't prove to me that life has a designer. Therefore, the design argument fails. Okay? Well, so I've got my own amendment to this debate. Okay? This is my amendment to the Paley-Hume debate. I finally resolved it after 200 years. The essential distinction between a pattern and a design is language. That is the ingredient that is present in a design and absent in a pattern. Watches and life both have language in common. Why? Because a watch either has a blueprint on paper or it has a blueprint in somebody's mind that preceded the making of the watch. All language comes from a mind, and the fundamental property, therefore, of all designs is that an idea precedes implementation. Language is the expression of ideas or the recording of ideas. If an idea exists in the form of a language before the idea is implemented physically, then it's a design. And the way you know is you look for a conception that precedes an implementation. And if that is true, then there is a language, therefore there is a designer. There are no exceptions to this. So, this is my atheist riddle. Show me a language that doesn't come from a mind. Just one.
Or the atheist would say DNA.
And I say, well, if that's true in principle, then I say, you do not know that. That is your hypothesis. That is not a proof. That is a hypothesis. So you have to show me an example that demonstrates that your hypothesis is validated. Okay, my argument is somewhere in some field of science, if a naturalistic process can produce a language, then there must be somewhere in engineering, mathematics, physics, chemistry, cybernetics, some field, there must be somewhere where somebody's seen a language that came from a natural process. I give you all of science. Any field you want, any book in the library you want, you go dig around. Show me one language that doesn't come from a mind. Yes? Well, but we know that even if we said that...
English, you mean? I'm saying everything. I mean, if the materialist thinks that everything came...
Here's the first thought I have. Because I worked in the industrial market, I sold these industrial networking cards that go in industrial computers that run robots, and they had all these weird protocols. And with names like, they weren't Ethernet, they were stuff like DeviceNet and Profibus and Modbus and Foundation Fieldbus. And then I'd have all these calls from customers. It seemed like every company in the world, they invented some computer protocol to run their machine that wasn't compatible with anybody else's. Okay, there's like a gazillion computer languages. You know, there's C and JavaScript and Pascal, and there's Fortran, and there's dead languages that never caught on. Okay? All of those things are languages. Every different version that you can save a Word document in, RTF, HTML, Word, you know, Word 2003, Word 97, every one of those things is a different language. So you go, how do languages create it? Somebody agrees on a protocol between a sender and a receiver. Okay, I save this as, I send it to you, you open it using the right program, and you can get it back. Microsoft Excel is a language. HTML is a language. PHP is a language. TCP/IP is a language. UDP, you know, I mean, all these funky computers, they're all languages. And then you have human languages. And then you have dogs barking. You know, dogs barking is a language too. Because one dog and another dog, by whatever process, but it's a mental process, they agree, you know, the male dog knows what the female dog sounds like when she's in heat. And he's like, on her, right? Okay? I mean, this is... And, you know, spider webs, I understand there's a certain kind of spiders, and the pattern on the web tells the other spider, I don't remember what, something. I mean, all of these things, they're languages. And so you can make up a language, you can make up Esperanto, you can make up Pig Latin. But it always requires agreement between a transmitter and receiver. If somebody gives you a computer file and they don't tell you what the extension is or what it is, they don't tell you anything about it, all you got is a bunch of ones and zeros and you have no idea how to open it, right? Anybody ever send you a file and they forgot to put the extension on? The extension in your computer is what tells you what language it is. And if you went and surfed around in your hard drive, you'd find there's like 100 different languages on your hard drive. And they're all a convention of symbols between a sender and a receiver.
Well, I'm thinking that
yes.
If someone creates a language with no one else's consent, it would still be a language.
Yeah, but it would still be an agreement to themselves.
It's not necessarily chaos.
Right, it's not chaos. It's I can create a language.
It still has meaning.
It may, why would I do that? It might be because I want to remember what I did last year. So I could write a diary in a language that I make up myself. And I don't have to tell anybody about it. But when I go back and read it, I become a receiver instead of being a sender. So, yes, sir.
I was thinking about language of the mind. And I know that linguists make a distinction between what humans do and what animals do.
Mm.
Because humans can be flexible in their code systems.
Right.
A dog cannot... say anything other than I'm in heat or
right.
Or you know, I want to drink some water. You know, that's the only thing they can communicate. It's a little bit like holding up little signs that have pre-written messages on them.
Right.
They can't rearrange the sign to make a completely new message.
Right. Now, I don't know how rigid that boundary is. Like, I don't know if maybe animals can come up with a certain amount of, you know, I imagine if two dogs were mates for 20 years, they would learn each other's patterns and they would understand each other. But it only goes so far where humans have this immense capacity for language. Like J.R.R. Tolkien, he learned a new language every year. His whole entire series, The Lord of the Rings, the characters, he invented the languages and then he developed characters and cultures to match the language he had invented. I mean, that like freaks me out. I'm like, good grief, how does anybody get that smart? I understand that he did he was contracted to do a commentary on the book of Job, and he hadn't even learned Hebrew yet. So he went and learned Hebrew, and he wrote a commentary on the book of Job, and then some scholars said, this is the best commentary anybody's ever written on the book of Job. And so language is this immensely rich thing. And when you think about it, think about the difference between a lousy writer and a mediocre and a good one and a really good one and a riveting novel. There are all these ingredients of language. Rhythm, poetry, onomatopoeia. I'm kind of drawing a blank. There's all these things, and the better a writer is, the more of these ingredients he can pack into a sentence. And so it's a top-down mental process. And so language really is the defining thing. So the riddle to atheists, show me a language that does not come from a mind. I like to say this is so simple, any child can understand it. that this riddle is so complex no atheist can solve it. You can't solve this riddle without a mind with a capital M. Let me tell you what made all these ideas gel for me. This is a book by Werner Gitt called In the Beginning Was Information. G-I-T-T. He's a German guy. This book was translated from German into English. It's actually, the translation is very good. You wouldn't guess that it's a translation. He's a professor of... He's basically got the same educational background as me, except he's been doing it 40 years longer. I am not an expert in cybernetics or anything like that, but he is robotics, automation, machines that, you know. And so he wrote this book, and I don't know how I stumbled across this, but I was searching for something, and I bumped into this book, and I bought it. And I got to tell you, every 2 or 3 years, I'll read some book that for whatever reason just goes wham, like ding-a-ling-a-ling, lights and bells and whistles going on off in my head and everything. That is what reading this book like was for me. Now, if you're not a technical person, you would not feel that way about this book. I'm an electrical engineer. I wrote a book on network communication protocols and stuff like that. And so this whole world of what I understood, I haven't really explained, you know, in the information technology world, this is this thing called a 7-layer model, and it starts with, like, you know, the volts on the wire, and it works its way up to all these levels of information and how information is represented in computers and how encoding, decoding systems work and error correction, all this. So all this was already in my head, and I read this book and it was like, boom. All of a sudden, my eyes are open to this whole distinction between information and patterns, and I've been grinding away on it for a year, and here I am talking to you about it, and obviously I think it's a really fascinating subject. So, you know, if you want to get ahead, skip a few steps, then you should pick up this book. But I will say is, as I've sort of processed and implemented it in my world and dialogued with people about it, I've added some of my own things, which we will talk about next time when we get together, because there's a whole nother set of questions that come up when you ask about, okay, then what about evolution? What about DNA? What about what can happen? What cannot happen? What are the limitations? And so, actually, I'll show you the first slide just to give you an attempt. A Christian and an atheist go to the zoo. And that sounds like the opening to a really bad joke. Or maybe it sounds like, it's like, well, you don't need to go to a zoo if you got a Christian and atheist. Christian and atheist talking to each other is a zoo, and it's like more entertaining. So you could go online and you can read all kinds of chats, but that's kind of the way that I frame the next part of this, which really gets to some interesting questions. Begin. If you were like geeked by this discussion, In the Beginning Was Information by Werner Gitt, great subject. I would also mention as sort of a second note that Gitt's book is an extension of one of the most important papers ever written in the field of electrical engineering. It was called The Mathematical Theory of Communication by Claude Shannon. Now let me explain what this is about. This is like a 50,000 foot view. This was a paper written by a Bell Labs guy named Claude Shannon in 1948. And this book lays the foundation for the entire digital age we live in. It formalizes the mathematics of sending and receiving information digitally. So this book, all the equations, and this is a book full of integrals and statistics and all this kind of stuff. This would not be something anybody but an engineer would ever want to read. But here's what this book is about. This book tells you, if you've got a 56K modem, and you're trying to get on the internet, how fast can that connection go? How many ones and zeros can you get through there? And how much information does that represent? And if you've got a certain amount of noise on the line, how much redundancy do you have to have in your data in order to keep it error-free? How much do errors compromise your communication? How much uncertainty is introduced when there's noise and static on the line? It tells you how much music you could store on a CD. It tells you the limitations of bandwidth and data storage, and it does it all. And it starts with basically a linguistic model of understanding language. Now, he only deals with the bottom two layers, which are statistics and syntax. He doesn't deal with the actual meaning of the message. He says in the preface that we don't deal with the meanings of message, which is an important part of this, but he's only dealing with at a level that a computer would understand. But what Werner Gitt did was he said, okay, Shannon built the base. Let's formalize the next couple of levels so that we have a workable way of dealing with information which helps us understand some of these evolution questions. And so that's what this is. And so when I started reading this, then I went out and I started looking on the internet, and I started finding that all of the people trying to argue with Werner Gitt have a like very fundamental mathematical flaws in their arguments. That they just simply do not understand what's being said, or they're purposely trying to manipulate it. And so it's like a really profound thing. So proof of intelligent design, language. It's that simple. Yes, sir?
Are you able to discuss metamutation?
Yes. 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 I'll give you a tool to go play with when you get home. I set up a little website. I hired a programmer. He wrote a little program for me. It's called randommutation.com. And what I'd like you to do is go to randommutation.com and play with it. And go get some text and paste it in there and see if you can get it to say anything that it didn't say before. You'll have fun. Yes, sir?
I did ask about your website besides the one you mentioned.
Oh, my website?
You have other websites too.
Well, I have my personal business website, which doesn't really talk about any of this to any extent. But I have two other websites that you guys would be interested in. One is called cosmicfingerprints.com, and it was sort of inspired when Hugh Ross came to town. I got to tell you guys, I was driving down the Interstate 88 one night with a cassette tape in my car, listening to Hugh Ross like 10 years ago give this talk that he gave at Willow Creek. And that was another one of those ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling things, because all this, you know, he's talking about the Big Bang and physics and the days of creation and fitting it all together. And it was one of those major epiphanies, you know. So I love Hugh Ross. So when Willow Creek did the Cosmic Fingerprints thing, I put together a little mini-series called Where Did the Universe Come From? And if you go to cosmicfingerprints.com, you get this little enticement, and you can sign up for it, and it sends you an email every day for 5 days, and it talks about the Big Bang and the fine-tuning of the universe, and it talks about information theory just a little bit, and then it talks about... then it's got a transcript of Hugh's talk that I heard on that tape 11 years ago. So cosmicfingerprints.com. The other site I've got is I've got a site called coffeehousetheology.com, and that is also a 7-day email series called Seven Great Lies of Organized Religion. At the beginning, you remember when I talked about coffeehousetheology.com. Remember in the beginning I talked about atheist writes a book, he sells it to a bunch of atheists, the Christian writes a book, he sells it to a bunch of Christians, and all the undecided people in the middle kind of just ignore everything. I think it's very important to talk to the people in the middle. So that's why I got these websites. I actually buy traffic on Google, and I send it to them, and it's become a really fascinating tool for dialogue, because when people get an email, a lot of times they reply to it, and it creates these dialogues. And so, anyway, you can go there and you can check that out. I think you'll find it interesting. And hey, this has been great. 2 hours, you're very patient. So,
thank you. Let's thank Barry.